department and briefly discussed any way they could improve the system. Then Martin said,
"I'd better go get the next row headed this way. We have to get through all of them before this row regenerates twofold."
About an hour later, four very tired adventurers pushed open the doors of Castle Cragganmore. Their arms felt like spaghetti, and they were drenched with sweat, but they were alive, and the soldiers who had stood in their way were not. They opened the doors wide enough to walk through, but the doors themselves were so large that they appeared to have only opened a crack. A thin shaft of daylight sliced through the darkness, paradoxically making it harder to see what was in the room, not easier. They pushed the doors closed again behind them, just in case the soldiers respawned in their original positions, rather than, like the wolves, where they'd been killed. Once the doors were closed, their eyes could adjust to the light that filtered in through the stained glass windows. There were large, decorative torches on every wall, but as it was still day, they were not lit. There was more than enough light to see by. It just did not seem like it at first, because everything visible was dark. Dark stone floors, supporting dark stone walls, beneath a dark stone ceiling, all illuminated by dark stained glass windows. The room was large and circular, with two symmetrical staircases leading to a nonsensically placed terrace at the back of the room. Beneath the terrace, there was a stone carving of what appeared to be a circular aperture, flanked by two large decorative mirrors. In the middle of the floor, two raised platforms held two levers. Britt shook her head and said,
"Look at this place."
Martin said,
"I know!"
Britt smirked at him before sighing.
"I've never understood why men think all you have to do to make something cool is to make it big and paint it black."
Martin said,
"I never understood why women think it's more complicated than that."
They shared a small chuckle, then turned their attention to Roy, who was standing on one of the two small platforms in the middle of the room, pushing on the lever that seemed to be the platform's reason for existing.
"Hey, Martin," Roy said, "why don't you apply a little elbow grease to that other lever? Let's see if we can make something happen."
Britt silently walked toward the second lever. Roy said,
"I said..."
"My elbows are just as greasy as his," Britt said.
She stepped up onto the platform and grasped the lever with both hands. Roy said,
"On three?"
Britt replied,
"That works."
Roy counted, and as he said,
"Three!"
they both easily pushed their levers forward. The room filled with the sound of giant heavy stones sliding against each other as the stone aperture opened. Britt and Roy made eye contact and in unison started to release their levers, which instantly caused the portal to close. They quickly pushed their levers forward again and the portal reopened. Britt said,
"Okay, I guess we're staying here. Gwen, Martin, you're up. I know you two haven't really been alone for a long time, but please don't spend too much time in there making out."
Gwen and Martin approached the threshold and saw a stone staircase and a seemingly infinite row of torches stretching off into the distance. After a quick promise to not waste too much time, they started down the stairs. After they'd gone far enough that they were sure they wouldn't be overheard, Gwen said,
"We should try to get back to them as quickly as we can. Poor Britt. She can't be happy stuck up there with Roy."
Martin said,
"Yeah. I don't think it's a picnic for Roy, either."
"I thought you liked Britt."
"I do. I like her a lot. And I actually think Roy thinks quite a bit of her, but just shows it badly."
Gwen said,
"He treats her like a weakling and bosses her around."
Martin smiled and said,
"Like I said, badly."
"That's not badly," Gwen said. "That's oppositely, if that's even a word."
Martin attempted to let the topic drop. He was not successful. After a few steps, Gwen said,
"Seriously, Martin, you're saying that he treats Britt and me like idiots because he likes us?"
"That isn't quite what I was saying," Martin said. "But yes, he thinks he's being strong and protective. If he didn't think you both deserved protection and strength, he wouldn't bother."
"So he thinks he should treat us like precious porcelain figurines."
Martin shrugged.
"I think he'd say he's trying to treat you like ladies."
Gwen looked at Martin in disbelief.
"Martin."
You agree with him, don't you?
Martin stopped walking and turned to face Gwen.
Look, that's not a fair question, and you know it.
Why not?
Gwen asked.
Because you're asking for a yes or no answer to a multiple choice question.
Gwen said,
This isn't the SAT, Martin.
Martin said, I know. I did well on my SAT.
Gwen didn't laugh or even smile, but she did noticeably relax, which was enough encouragement for Martin to continue.
Look, he said, you and I are from 2012. Britt's from the 1990s. Roy was born in something like 1930. Think about that for a minute.
Gwen said,
That doesn't justify his attitude.
No, Martin said.
But it explains it.
Gwen, I look at you and Britt and I see modern women. He looks at you and he sees creatures from the friggin' future. A future he can barely imagine. He came here from the 70s. Do you know how awful things were back then? The women Roy's friends would have considered crazy, hardcore feminists were demanding jobs. That's it. Jobs that weren't nursing, sewing, or food service. They weren't even demanding equal pay yet, because they wanted to be realistic.
Martin continued down the stairs. Gwen followed.
So, what are you telling me?
Gwen asked.
Britt and I should take his behavior as a compliment? Should we thank him for belittling us?
Not at all, Martin said. I think you both have played things about right. What's that called when psychologists electrocute you when you do something wrong? Abhorrent conditioning, I think? Anyway, he won't learn that he's doing the wrong thing unless you two show him that he is. So I say, keep up the good work!
I'd just appreciate it if you try not to hate him.
He's a grumpy old cuss, but he's not a bad guy. It's not that he doesn't respect you. He just respects you wrong.
At last, they reached the bottom of the stairs and found themselves in a large room. The center of the room was a statue of a six-armed warrior. In his six hands, he brandished six knives, the blades of which were polished to a mirror finish. On the far wall, there was an intricately carved door that was covered with strange symbols. On each side of the door, there were three stone cylinders, about the height of a man, which also held carved hieroglyphics, though much larger than the ones on the doors. In front of both sets of cylinders, there was a rail holding a small mirror. Along the sides of the room, six braziers held six roaring fires, the light from which was focused by large lenses toward the statue in the middle of the room. Gwen and Martin surveyed the scene silently for a moment. Then Gwen said,
Puzzle. Obviously, Martin replied. I'll take the left side, Gwen said. You take the right.
Martin said,
Cool.
And they went about their work. The statue stood in an exaggerated squat that looked fearsome and allowed people of normal human height to use its legs as a place to stand. Gwen and Martin climbed up on the statue's bent knees and started pulling on the arms, each of which were attached to the torso via a swivel joint at the shoulder. Each arm easily swung into position with a satisfying click, and the light from one of the braziers, focused by the lenses, reflected off the dagger blades to illuminate one of the symbols on the door. In short order, they had all six arms in position and six glyphs highlighted. They moved on to the cylinders, which turned smoothly but slowly. Martin spun the columns until the three symbols displayed on their fronts matched the three illuminated on the door closest to him. He turned to check on Gwen's progress and found her smirking at him with her arms crossed.
You done?
He asked.
Yep, she answered.
Hmm,
Martin said.
Then why isn't the door opening?
He pushed and pulled on the door. It didn't move.
Are you done with your side?
Gwen asked.
Martin said, Yeah.
Are you sure?
Yes,
Martin said.
I think.
He looked at the cylinders. The markings matched. He thought for a moment, casting his eyes around the room.
The mirror!
Martin moaned.
I totally forgot about the mirror!
Martin stood between the cylinders and the mirror, then swung the mirror around so he was looking at the cylinders And of course, when looked at this way, the symbols were backward and in the wrong order. He spun the first cylinder until he found a glyph that was the reversed version of the symbol on the last cylinder. Gwen smiled approvingly. As he arranged the other two cylinders, Martin said,
I gotta admit, these puzzles are a lot more tiring when you're actually physically doing them, instead of sitting on your couch with a controller, watching Lara Croft do the work.
Tomb Raider, huh? Gwen said. I preferred Uncharted.
Well, I'm a dude, and Lara Croft is fun to look at.
I'm a chick, and I feel the same way about Nathan Drake.
Martin shrugged and continued spinning the cylinders.
And Victor Sullivan?
Gwen continued. Martin turned to face her, grinning.
Really? The old guy?
Yeah, why not? Age differences like that don't always bother women. Look at Philip and Britt.
Martin said,
Britt's older than Philip.
Mentally, Gwen said. Physically, she's much younger.
Martin said,
Age differences like that don't always bother men. Almost never, in fact.
Martin slid the last glyph into place, and the doors swung open on their own. Gwen and Martin crept into the dark passage beyond the door. The only sound was the rustling of their own clothing. They could see a well-lit room waited at the end of the hall, but there was no source of light between there and where they were. As they approached the light, their view of the room grew wider and cleared. They saw a fortune in gold and other assorted loot, piled and heaped in such large amounts that it couldn't help but look terribly fake. In the midst of the gold there was a throne. The arms of the throne and its backrest, seat cushion, and the floor around it were stained with blood, in such large amounts of it that it couldn't help but look terribly real. Across from the throne there was a table, and on that table there was a familiar-looking ornate metal birdcage. Inside the birdcage there was an ornate metal bird, just like the one back at the mine, except this one was not moving, seemingly frozen in mid-flutter. It hung motionless in the air, beak open, wings outstretched. On the floor just behind the table, there was the body of a portly man in a filthy jester costume, lying motionless, arms akimbo, and face down on the floor with his head turned away. There was no sign of blood, gore, or decomposition of any kind, and he was clearly not a real person. That only made the sight of him more disturbing. Anyone involved in a healthy, long-term romantic relationship can tell when their partner wants to leave a place. Usually the place in question is some place the other person does not want to leave. A party, a Broadway musical, or a sports bar with scantily clad waitresses. In this case, both Martin and Gwen were able to tell that neither of them felt like hanging around. So they simply walked in, grabbed the cage, and walked out again, without ever having to discuss it. Britt shifted her weight, adjusting her stance so that the lever's handle dug into a different part of her anatomy. Using her body weight to hold the door open didn't require a lot of strength, but it still had its cost. Early on, she had been forced to make a choice. She could have a single, smallish bruise that went clear to the bone, or she could spread the damage around and end up with a less painful bruise that had more surface area. Once she was confident with her new position, she turned her attention back to the conversation at hand.
So, she asked, about the SR-71. I understand that the friction of the speeds it flew caused so much expansion that the skin panels had to be made smaller than usual, and that at room temperature the whole plane had big, honking panel gaps.
Yep. If you looked too closely, it looked like we'd had the thing built by British Leyland.
Roy was sitting on the floor, leaning back on his lever as if it were a backrest.
That's a car company that makes crummy cars.
Yeah, I know, Britt said. They did, anyway. They're long gone in my time.
I'm not surprised. How's a young lady like you know about all this guy stuff?
Britt chose to let the young lady bit slide, and instead focused on how she knew about all this guy stuff.
Roy, she said, I love machines, and engineering, and problem-solving. Before I found the file, I was going to be an architect. I know things.
Roy scoffed.
Well, Now, I don't know what all you know, but I'll tell you something I know. Saying you are going to be something isn't the same as being that thing.
What's that supposed to mean?
Britt asked, despite the fact that she knew exactly what it was supposed to mean.
Just that reading about building things isn't the same as actually building things, that's all.
Roy explained.
Britt said, I built a city. An entire city. Atlantis. You've been there.
Roy said,
yeah, about that. I've always been hazy on how that whole thing happened. When did you build Atlantis?
Britt said, about 40 years from now.
Roy waved his hand dismissively.
Yeah, great, I know. We're all time travelers, great. What I'm asking is, to you, from your point of view, when did you build the city?
That's what I'm trying to tell you, Britt explained. From my point of view, the city will be built 38 years from now.
Roy smiled.
Oh, so what you're saying is that you didn't build Atlantis. Britt the Elder did.
Britt said, she's me!
Roy said,
not yet she isn't.
Britt said, besides, the city is based on my plans and ideas.
Roy said,
ugh, ideas don't impress me as much as execution. Sorry, kid, but where I come from, we judge people by what they've done, not what they say they'll do.
I'm not telling you what I will do, Britt said. I'm telling you what I will have done.
Roy mulled this over for a moment, then said,
yeah, well, I don't know what to think of that.
Britt admitted, neither do I, most days.
The conversation might have continued, but they were distracted by the sound of footsteps echoing up the staircase behind them. Roy and Britt glanced at each other, silently confirming that they would enact the plan they had hatched shortly after they'd stopped actively pushing on the levers and had started leaning on them. Roy smiled, Britt nodded, and they both started arranging themselves as discussed. Gwen and Martin walked up the stairs much more slowly than they had walked down. With each step, the light from the door at the top of the stairs grew brighter. The fact that there was light at all was reassuring, as it meant that Britt and Roy were still there to keep the door open. As they reached the last few steps, and their heads rose above the level of the main chamber's floor, they could see Roy and Britt doing their jobs. Roy was leaned over, holding the lever with both hands and bracing it with his shoulder. His knuckles were white with exertion. His feet struggled to find traction in the slick marble floor. Britt had spun around to the other side of her lever and was hanging from it by one elbow, using her other arm to keep herself from slipping. Roy looked up, saw Martin and Gwen, and gasped,
"Hurry up! We can't hold it forever!"
Both Gwen and Martin practically threw themselves through the portal, only taking care to not damage the birdcage with its frozen cargo in the process. They were barely free of the door when Roy rolled sideways off of his lever, allowing it to spring back into its original position. Britt merely let go of her lever, falling to the ground in a panting heap. Martin said,
"Guys, we're sorry. We went as fast as we could."
Roy massaged his hands. Britt sat up, shoulders sagging, and limply held up a hand, signaling that a response would come when it was darn good and ready. After several heavy breaths, she said,
"We know. We know. You did your best, I'm sure. A few times I turned to Roy and I said, 'We have to hold on. Martin and Gwen are counting on us.' Didn't I say that, Roy?"
"Yeah,"
Roy agreed.
"I knew she was right, but it took you so long. I was sure something terrible had happened. All we could do was worry and hold on as long as we could."
Martin said, "Oh, guys, we're sorry. It must have been terrible."
"It was,"
Britt said.
"Roy cried."
Roy instantly looked furious with Britt. Britt looked at him innocently and said,
"Isn't that right, Roy?"
Through gritted teeth, Roy said,
"I didn't think you were going to tell them that."
Gwen walked over to Roy and put a hand on his shoulder.
Oh, come on, Roy. It's all right. You have nothing to be ashamed of. I'm sure you cry all the time.
Roy looked up at Gwen and said,
Thanks for that.
Martin offered Britt a hand up, which she accepted. Once she was on her feet, Martin asked,
Why didn't you just lean back on the lever? It might have been easier than hanging from it.
Britt said,
Really, Martin? You're going to second-guess us? You don't know what went on up here. You don't know what all we tried.
Martin quickly said,
You're right, I'm sorry.
Britt glared at him for a moment, then looked down at the birdcage, saying,
So, the bird was there?
Martin said,
Yeah, but he's not right.
Martin held up the cage so Britt and Roy could get a good look. The metal bird was still frozen in place, hovering in midair above its perch, wings frozen mid-flight. Martin spun the cage around so they could see that the bird remained motionless in relation to the cage, no matter how it moved.
Weird,
Roy said, summing the situation up nicely.
Yeah, Gwen agreed, and it wasn't the only thing that was a bit off. There was a jester down there who didn't seem to be dead or even really hurt. He was just lying perfectly still, face down on the floor.
Britt said,
Yeah, that does seem like some kind of glitch. Any sign of what messed things up?
Martin and Gwen exchanged a quick look. Then Martin said,
Well, there was also a lot of blood down there.
The jesters?
Roy asked.
No,
Gwen said.
It was on the other side of the room.
That silenced all conversation, while they all thought seriously about whose blood it might have been.
Roy said, Speaking of blood, we should get moving. Every second we stay here, the more likely that those soldiers have regenerated.
Martin pushed the immense doors open a crack and peeked through, fearing that he'd find a sea of soldiers all waiting their turn to attack him. Instead, the courtyard was empty. He pushed the door open far enough to poke his head out and look from side to side. He saw nobody. He pushed the doors open and walked out into the open air, followed by the others.
Looks like they haven't regenerated, Martin said.
At least they haven't regenerated here, Gwen said. Two wolves usually respawn where one was killed, so if the soldiers did come back, there'll be twice as many of them around that corner.
She pointed down the only path leading to or from the castle, which turned left in the distance and went behind the wall of the canyon, creating the natural hiding spot they had used earlier.
Martin said, I'll sneak up there and see if the coast is clear. It's the least I can do after what we put you two through.
Martin jogged away. Roy said,
That's decent of him.
Britt said,
Well, I'm sure he feels terrible. He knows it had to be bad if it made a big, strong man like you cry.
Roy grimaced and said,
Humph.
Britt said,
Like a little girl.
Roy glared at her, then focused on the frozen bird in the cage he was holding. Gwen made eye contact with Britt. Britt shrugged. Gwen continued her eye contact. Britt shrugged again. Gwen raised her eyebrows. Britt blushed a bit and nearly laughed. Gwen nearly laughed too, and might have, if not for the distant yelp and the sight of Martin running their way, pursued by 16 regenerated soldiers.
15. Gary walked into the cabin with the blonde Gwen on his arm, cooing in his ear about how nice it was to have visitors. Behind him, the redhead entered holding Tyler's hand, gushing about how rough and manly it felt. The brunette Gwen entered walking backward, holding both of Jimmy's hands, leading him forward and gazing over every inch of him, as if he were a priceless work of art. Philip followed them in, alone and grumpy. Philip had no sooner crossed the threshold before the black-haired Gwen appeared and clung to his side as if drawn there by magnets. From the outside, the building had seemed like a normal medieval dwelling, larger than usual, but of conventional design and made of predictable materials. Inside, it was a different story. They entered a large room that looked as if a swinging bachelor from the late 60s had attempted to decorate his pad using materials he stole from a Renaissance fair. The floor on which they stood formed an elevated ring around the perimeter of the room. Set into the middle of the floor was a sunken seating area, the kind of thing that used to be called a conversation pit. Although the silky pillows and cushions that lined the sofas and the floor made Philip doubt that it had been designed with conversation in mind. Along one wall there was a bar with several bottles of no doubt intoxicating liquids, ranging in color from perfectly clear to dark brown. On another wall there was a fireplace with a roaring fire and the mandatory bearskin rug. The third wall held a staircase leading upstairs and a series of pegs. Various garments hung from the pegs. At a glance, they seemed period accurate, but when Philip looked for a moment, he saw that in addition to the expected fur and leather items, there were garments made of gauze, denim, plaid, and something that looked like shiny black plastic. Gary, Tyler, and Jimmy allowed themselves to be led down into the pit, where they were gently placed into seats and gently fussed over. Philip said, "No thanks," and walked over to the fireplace instead. He immediately took off the multiple robes he'd been wearing in an unsuccessful attempt to stay warm. The black-haired Gwen took each filthy robe as if it were a treasure. Philip crouched before the fire, warming his hands while the black-haired Gwen watched, waiting for him to remove more clothes. Once everyone seemed comfortable, the blonde Gwen drew back from Gary and said,
"After your long journey, you must be terribly hungry."
Gary arched his eyebrows in a way he hoped was suave and said,
"Yes, very."
She drew her face closer to his and said,
"I bet it's been a long time since you've had a good meal."
"It's been so long," Gary said. "So long."
The blonde Gwen giggled and said,
"Well, we'll be right back, and then you'll have as much food as you like."
She and the other Gwens all stood up as if on cue and walked out of the room through a door next to the bar. Philip stood by the fire, looking at the other three men lying prone among the cushions, looking forlornly at the door through which the Gwens had just left.
"You're pathetic," he said. "It's no wonder women don't respect men."
Tyler said,
"Women don't respect men because we didn't respect them first. It's retaliation."
Gary added,
"And we're not pathetic. We're just playing them, drawing them out, hoping they'll tip their hand."
Philip said,
"Yeah, I bet."
"Relax, Philip," Jimmy said. "We're in complete control of the situation. We're not going to let it go any further than it already has. We've all got our guard up."
Philip said,
"Yeah, I can see that."
Tyler said, "Come on, Phil. You knew what we'd find in here. You knew it would be something like this."
"That's it, Tyler. Todd, if he's going to watch any part of this little misadventure he's cooked up for us, it'll be this. Anyway, Todd designed this whole scenario to be irresistibly seductive. Look around you guys. We're standing in a sexist buffoon's idea of romance."
"And credit where it's due," Gary said. "I think what he came up with is pretty effective."
"Yeah,"
Philip agreed, scowling.
"That's why it angers me."
The door to the next room reopened, and the four Gwens returned, each carrying a lidded platter. Three settled in next to Jimmy, Tyler, and Gary. The one with black hair stood next to Philip, brandishing her platter. She glanced down to her own cleavage, then looked up at Philip expectantly and said,
"Are you hungry?"
Philip groaned.
"I feel like I owe every woman on the planet an apology, including you."
The artificial Gwen did not seem to understand the response. Gary said,
"Yes, he's hungry. We're all hungry." In unison, the Gwens removed the lids from their platters to reveal grapes, cherries, bite-sized chunks of melon and pineapple, small cubes of cheese, and what appeared to be wood and brass medieval analogs of cans of aerosol whipped cream. Philip squeezed the bridge of his nose and said, "Oh, Lord."
I know, right?
Gary said, almost giggling. The blonde, brunette, and red-headed Gwens each delicately picked up a morsel of food from their platters and slowly pushed them toward the men's mouths. Jimmy, Tyler, and Gary dutifully opened their mouths to receive their first bite. Philip gently grasped the black-haired Gwen's wrist with one hand and took the piece of fruit with the other, popping it into his mouth. The black-haired Gwen withdrew her hand and sucked the juice from her fingertips while looking deeply into Philip's eyes. Philip looked away while he chewed his pineapple chunk. Without looking back, he asked her, "What's your name?" The black-haired Gwen purred,
"I'm the one with black hair."
"He didn't even bother to give them names,"
Philip said, straining the words through gritted teeth. Philip sat down on the bearskin rug, sighing heavily. The one with black hair put down the platter and lowered herself to the floor as well, though she didn't sit on the rug so much as she stretched her legs out to one side, keeping them together but bent to accentuate the flare of her hips and the narrowness of her waist. Her torso remained upright, her weight supported by one hand, while the other explored the surface of the rug. She slowly ran her fingers through the long fur, humming with pleasure. She said.
"It feels so soft and warm on my skin."
"The skin of your hand?"
Philip asked. She gave him a heavy-lidded look in the eyes and said,
"Yes."
She held her hand out to him. Philip shook his head, then picked up the platter of food from the floor and turned so he could eat it without looking at the black-haired Gwen. He said, to anyone who was listening,
"I noticed these simulations adapt a little better to our responses."
"Yeah," Tyler agreed. "He probably put more time into writing this part of the program."
"Yeah,"
Philip said.
"I bet he did. I'm sure this part of the quest has been rigorously tested."
Down in the seating area, the other men were thoroughly enjoying their meal. The blonde Gwen had just placed a grape in Gary's mouth and was reaching for a cherry when he shook his head no and nodded toward the can of whipped cream. Blonde Gwen smiled wickedly and picked up the can. The can was made out of very small barrel staves, held together with small riveted brass hoops. The domed brass top was tipped with a nozzle that looked like carved ivory. She lifted the can and dispensed some whipped cream onto her index finger, which she offered to Gary. He accepted the offer. She started to put more of the whipped cream on her finger, but he again shook his head no and opened his mouth wide. She aimed the nozzle at his mouth and fired. She was a tad overzealous, and whipped cream went all over Gary's face. Gary laughed.
"Oh, you poor dear," she said. "I guess we'll have to go get you cleaned up."
"Yes," Gary said. "That! We have to do that!"
The blonde stood up and offered Gary her hand. He leapt to his feet and took her hand. He beamed down at Tyler and Jimmy.
"I'm gonna go get cleaned," he said.
"So we heard," Jimmy said.
"Yes,"
Gary said.
"You did hear it, right?"
"Yes, we did,"
Tyler agreed. Gary said,
"Good,"
as the blonde led him by the hand to the staircase. He glanced over and saw Philip sitting cross-legged on the bearskin rug, holding the platter of fruit chunks as if it were a paper plate at a summer barbecue, miserably eating while the black-haired Gwen watched his every move adoringly.
"Don't worry, Philip,"
Gary said as he and the blonde walked up the stairs.
"I'll be vigilant. No detail will escape my notice."
Philip muttered,
"He's gonna get himself killed."
"Well, he's gonna get himself something,"
Tyler said, chewing a strawberry while the red-headed Gwen looked on adoringly.
Lighten up, Philip. He's not a dummy.
Philip stared at Tyler.
Not as big a dummy as you think, Tyler said. Besides, it's easy for you to take the high road here. You're the only one of us with a steady girlfriend.
Philip said,
First of all, that shouldn't matter,
Tyler said. But we all know it does.
Secondly, Philip continued, Gary hits on every woman he meets. Constantly.
Yeah, Tyler said.
Do you think that means he has a lot of success?
That's a good point, Jimmy said, peeking around the side of the brunette Gwen's head to make eye contact with Philip. Do you really keep looking for something after you found it?
Philip lapsed into a sullen silence, quietly munching his mixed fruit and cheese platter and trying not to listen to Jimmy and Tyler slurp and giggle their way through theirs. After a few more chunks of fruit, Jimmy said,
Hey, Tyler, you want to take your bath next?
Of course Tyler did, but he was deeply suspicious of anything Jimmy did, especially if it seemed like an act of kindness. Tyler glared at Jimmy, then said,
Why? Why do you want me to? You trying to get me out of the room for some reason?
Jimmy said,
No, I'm just trying to figure out the order. Honestly, Tyler, I know you don't trust me, but you're going to have to let me out of your sight, unless you want to watch me take my bath.
Tyler thought a moment, then said,
I've decided to trust you, for now.
Jimmy said, Splendid, and went back to allowing himself to be fed. Philip spent a moment contemplating his view of the back half of the brunette Gwen until he snapped out of it and averted his eyes. His gaze resettled, quite naturally, on his side view of the red-headed Gwen. Philip physically turned his face away and found himself looking directly at the black-haired Gwen, staring at him, smiling. Philip looked at the floor.
How are any of us going to face Gwen after this?
Tyler said,
the same way we face every woman we fantasized about, but not had sex with.
Which is a lot of them,
Jimmy added. Philip looked up from the floor and watched Jimmy and Tyler enjoy their meal for a moment before saying,
This is a lot more than just a fantasy, Tyler.
Yes, Tyler allowed, but it's a lot less than sex.
Philip said,
Yeah, for now.
He glanced at the staircase.
For us.
You're worried about Gary? Tyler asked.
Yes,
Philip answered.
Well, don't be. He may act dumb sometimes, but I trust him. I promise you, Philip, he's in complete control of the situation.
Upstairs, in the bathroom, Gary was in complete control of the situation. He had entered the room, seen the bathtub full of warm, soapy water, and had decided that the only prudent course of action was to immediately disrobe.
I'm supposed to be taking a bath, right? You don't do that in your clothes, he thought. That would be crazy.
He started removing his clothes, then turned to see if the blonde Gwen was watching him undress. She was. As he continued to undress, he watched her watching him undress. As always happens whenever someone watches you do something you usually do alone, Gary was gripped with the uneasy feeling that he was undressing wrong, and that the false Gwen was judging him.
Get a grip, he thought. You're taking off your pants. As long as you end up not wearing pants, you can't be doing it wrong.
Despite his internal pep talk, the surveillance had him so unnerved that he did end up tugging at his pants as they pooled flaccidly around his ankles before realizing that in order to fully remove them, he would have to lift at least 1 foot off the ground. Gary got down to his underwear. They were the style commonly called tighty-whities. Though after having been worn for so long and while covering so much distance, they were no longer either white or tight. He knew they were not flattering, but he couldn't quite force himself to remove them. He turned to gauge the blonde Gwen's reaction to the sight of him mostly undressed. She did not scream and flee, which he took as a positive sign. She also did not disrobe herself, which he found less encouraging.
Okay. Fun is fun, Gary thought, but I can't let this go any further.
Gary slowly approached her. She did not retreat or look away.
I mean it, he told himself. I can't let this go too much further.
Soon he was kissing her, and she was kissing him back. He carefully started untying the laces of her peasant blouse. She made no move to stop him. Gary thought, seriously, I can never let anyone know how far I'm letting this go. Gary stopped thinking. He felt her in his arms. He heard her breathing, heavy in his ear. He felt her fingernails digging into his back, her movements becoming jerky and uncoordinated. The sound of her breath took on a wet, panting quality. In a deep, husky growl, she said,
I'll gnaw the meat from your ribcage.
Gary said,
if that's what you're into, baby.
He continued kissing her, moving down to the base of her neck, when she started swinging her head a bit more violently than he would have liked. He was becoming dimly aware that she no longer seemed to be actively engaged in the project. He opened his eyes and looked at the shoulder he was kissing and thought,
I'm pretty sure that wasn't mint green before.
Gary drew back from the woman, holding her at arm's length to get a good look. Her flesh was green and wet. The centers of her eyes were white, and her teeth were black, the opposite of how Gary usually liked it. Her cloud of blonde hair had become slick, slimy, and matted.
I can make this work, he thought.
He tried kissing her again, but his heart wasn't really in it. It was over. She croaked,
You will suffer a thousand torments before this night is through.
Gary sighed.
Don't.
He let go of her and looked around the room. The walls were decrepit and covered with mold. The inviting tub full of hot, clear water was now filthy and full of green slime. Zombie Gwen stood where he left her, hissing and sputtering, but she made no move to attack. He turned and took two steps to get back to his clothes, which still sat in a heap where he'd left them on the floor. He became aware of Zombie Gwen closing in on him very rapidly. He stopped, whipping around to defend himself. She stopped just short of him, snarling threateningly, but not making any move to actually harm him.
You will beg me for mercy, she said. Mercy you will not get.
Gary mumbled, Yeah, I wish. Then, playing a hunch, he took one large step backward. She lurched forward exactly as far as he had, but no farther.
It's just like the bridge and the river rocks, he thought. Keep us moving, but don't actually kill us.
Zombie Gwen slavered and snapped crazily at Gary, but she did not move any closer to him. He glared back at her while he slowly pulled his clothes back on. When he was fully dressed, he walked back down the stairs with Zombie Gwen following right behind, closely enough that he could hear her wet breathing and feel the wind from her repeated attempts to grab him, but not close enough to actually make physical contact.
Hey, guys, he said. We were right. It's a trap.
As his head dipped below the ceiling of the first floor, he saw that the seductive decor of the room had been replaced with splintered rotten wood and moldering filth. Tyler and Jimmy were standing ankle-deep in a pit of muck that had been the conversation pit. Standing next to them were two identical copies of the zombified Gwen that pursued Gary. The only difference was that instead of a matted slick of sickly blonde hair, they had wet mops of red and brown hair falling limply from their scalps. They hissed and cursed and slobbered, but they remained roughly arm's length from Tyler and Jimmy, and seemed rooted in place.
Oh, Gary said. You know.
Yeah, Tyler said. We kind of figured it out for ourselves.
The first hint was when a piece of cantaloupe turned into maggots in my mouth, Jimmy said. Nothing like that tends to get your attention.
Philip said,
At least you got some protein.
He was standing in front of the long dormant fireplace, on a rotted, moldy rug, next to a black-haired deadite who seemed to want to tear out his jugular with her teeth, but could not quite bring herself to do it. Tyler said,
"Man, you don't have to act so happy about this."
Philip said,
"No, I don't have to, but I choose to. Really, guys, you didn't think this was going to have a happy ending, did you? With you settling down with your Gwen-shaped pleasure replicants and having kids?"
Gary ambled down the stairs, followed by his evil Gwen.
"No," he said, "I didn't picture that, but I was hoping for a happy ending."
Tyler looked at the hellish effigy of Gwen nearest him.
"You will beg me to let you die," she said.
"You're all talk," Tyler said.
After a moment's thought, Tyler continued to the whole group.
"Everything here is. I'm beginning to think that since Ty killed Jeff, the only real danger we've faced has been the danger we put ourselves in. Walking on narrow ledges and playing with pointy weapons. I don't think the wolves would even kill us if we let them. They'd probably just chew on us without breaking the skin."
Gary said,
"That still sounds irritating."
"Yeah,"
Tyler said,
"but not deadly. That's Todd's game. He wants to keep us moving, but he also wants to keep us alive. I bet we could still spend the night in this house, no problem. We just have to trap the Gwens here in another room. Hopefully one outside of hearing range."
Philip surveyed the room and said,
"I don't know. I mean, I think you're right, but this doesn't seem like a very pleasant place to spend the night."
"Yeah,"
Gary said.
"It would have been before. I think things went sour when I tried to get my freak on."
"Not the first time that's happened,"
Philip said.
"Perhaps the fact that you call it getting your freak on is part of the problem."
Tyler considered the red-haired zombie Gwen.
"They're not really people. They're artificial characters, just like the miners and the wolves. I wonder, if we killed them, would two more pop up in their place? And would they be like these, or would the new ones revert to the way they were before?"
Jimmy said,
"I have a better idea. They follow us, right? Why not hitch them up to the sledge? Then we could walk out in front, and they'd pull all the weight."
Without warning, a rectangle of light appeared on the wall and quickly resolved itself into a program window, showing the feed from Todd's webcam. The kitchen, visible over his left shoulder, was untidy. The living space to his right was no better. He looked tired, unshaven, and angry. Todd said,
"I figured you'd be scared when the lady's all putrefied. I honestly thought you had higher standards than this."
Gary said,
"Glad to disappoint you."
Todd took a long sip from the straw of a large carbonated beverage, then said,
"I hate you. All of you. I go to all this trouble to create a quest, and you jerks just can't wait to screw it up."
Gary said,
"Todd, we didn't screw it up. You did. You made a death trap. They won't actually kill us. Who does that?"
"It won't kill you yet, Gary,"
Todd said.
"It will kill you. Make no mistake. I killed Jeff, and I will kill you too. Just not yet. Right now, I'm just prolonging the suffering."
"Well, that's more reason for us to not cooperate,"
Tyler said, folding his arms. Todd looked down at the four of them and let out a long breath.
"Look," he said, "you're right. A lot of the stuff I've thrown at you so far has been designed to keep you moving without actually killing you. I saw that you were onto it on day one."
"When I told you that I was onto you?"
Tyler suggested. Todd ignored him.
"The wolves seemed to work okay, so I figured you'd forgotten. But the River Rock showed that you hadn't. I've been calibrating the later challenges to be more dangerous. I just hadn't gotten to the Temptresses yet. Don't worry. From here on out, the dangers you face will be real." "Actually, I guess you should worry.
So you say, Jimmy said. But why shouldn't we just assume that you're just saying that to scare us, and that you'll go right back to prolonging our agony?
Todd leaned into the camera so that his face filled the entire window.
Because you idiots are getting on my nerves now, and I'm not really interested in prolonging my own agony. I plan to take a more active role in things from now on. I'm really looking forward to watching you die, one at a time, for my amusement. I'm getting impatient.
Well, fine, Jimmy said. We'll just get a good night's sleep in this house you provided for us, then tomorrow we'll hitch your sisters here up to our sledge, and we can all get on with it.
Todd smiled.
You're welcome to spend the night. In fact, let me make it a little cozier for you.
At the bottom of the window, the tops of Todd's hands moved a bit. The familiar sound of a computer keyboard filtered up. Fire flared from the corners of the room and raced along the edge of the floor as if following a trail of gasoline. The flames consumed the corners of the floor, leaving an ever-decreasing area in which the wizards could stand. The walls of the building began to creak and groan. The ceiling bowed downward alarmingly. Philip joined Tyler, Gary, and Jimmy in the middle of the room. The Gwens receded into the inferno and were engulfed. Waves of unbearable heat lashed the wizards. Tyler pointed toward the door and shouted, "Typical!" The others saw that there was a narrow, flame-free path leading to the front door, which was open, offering a clear view of the cold night air outside.
"Gosh, Todd! I get the feeling you might want us to go outside!"
Tyler shouted at Todd, whose image was still leering at them from the wall. Todd said,
"You picked up on that, eh? Well, you'd better get to it. I can force you to move on with fire, or I could just fill the building with wolves. Ooh! Or how's this idea grab you? Fire wolves! I'll have to work on that. In the meantime..."
As Todd's voice trailed off, the heat intensified. The flames leapt higher into the air and started to work their way up the walls. The wizards could feel their skin crisping, and they instinctively ran for the door. Because of where he'd been standing when the flames appeared, Philip was the last one in line as they dashed for the exit. Even as his feet were fleeing the heat, some part of Philip's brain realized that he was also fleeing into the cold, and that he didn't have his fur cloak, or even his three robes, to protect him from the chill. He noticed again that there were coat hooks on the wall next to the door. There were still garments hanging from the hooks. Since the cabin had transformed, they were now dusty and covered with cobwebs and mildew. A few of them were on fire, but the others seemed serviceable. He didn't have time to make a careful selection, so he snatched the two largest and least flaming objects as he fled through the door and out into the chill night air. They stood a safe distance from the blazing cabin, panting and feeling grateful to be safe, until Gary pointed toward the inferno and yelled, "The rock!" The heavy lump of dull gray diluine ore was where they had left it, less than 5 feet from the porch, which meant that now it and the very flammable wooden sledge that made it easier to transport were less than 5 feet from the fire. As they watched, they could see smoke rising from the raw timbers of the sledge. They ran back toward the fire. They pushed and heaved and attempted to smother the fire with curse words. Finally, they got the sledge back to where they'd been, a safe distance from the fire, and panted from their exertion, grateful to be alive.
"Well,"
Jimmy heaved between breaths,
"at least we won't have trouble keeping warm tonight."
The flaming cabin extinguished as suddenly as if someone had flipped a switch, because that's essentially what had happened. Jimmy glanced at the sky and said,
"Good one."
Philip stumbled over to the two garments he'd rescued from the fire. He'd thrown them on the ground when they dashed back to save the sledge. Now he had time to shake the dirt out of them and see exactly what he had. The larger and warmer looking of the two items turned out to be a fur coat, a slinky, full-length, silver and gray-striped lady's fur that instantly tore at the shoulder seams when he put it on, and would not close around his middle. On the plus side, the fur was thick, warm and soft, with a high collar that would help keep his neck and ears from getting cold, and large cuffs that would help protect his hands. The others watched him test his range of motion, each gyration of his torso accompanied by a small tearing sound from the shoulder seams. Tyler looked at the second item lying on the ground and asked, "What else did you get?" Philip lifted the garment and held it up in the moonlight. It was a tank top, made of shiny black plastic. It had surprising cutouts in obvious places. Philip said,
"I don't believe it would fit."
Tyler said, "Thanks for not trying." 16. Fighting their way through the reconstituted soldier corps had really taken a toll. Britt, Gwen, Roy, and Martin put what they thought was a safe distance between themselves and the spot where eventually twice as many soldiers would appear, then unanimously agreed to rest for the night. They took turns keeping watch and ended up sleeping well into the next day. They still did not make great time, now being overtired from too much sleep. They covered about half the distance back to the mine, camped for the night again, and finally returned to the mines of Mortlach late on the next day. The miners fell into an awed silence as they entered the mine, Gwen in the lead, carrying the ornate birdcage holding the frozen mechanical bird. At first, they worried that the miners would see that something was wrong with Oban, but those fears died when they reached Blandoch, the head of the mining guild. He stood along the back wall, next to an identical birdcage in which an identical mechanical bird was whistling and fluttering joyfully. Blandoch looked like a child on Christmas morning as he took the second cage from Gwen. He peered at the frozen bird inside. The other bird, in the cage that sat on the plinth, chirped happily, and Blandoch, never removing his eyes from the frozen canary, giggled with delight. Blandoch placed the cage in his hands on the plinth, knocking the other bird cage on the ground in the process as if he did not see it. When the new cage was sitting on the plinth for which it was clearly designed, the Oban in the cage that had just clattered to the floor flew a neat loop-the-loop in its cage and landed back on its perch, which was impressive, as the cage was on its side and the perch was perpendicular to the ground. The miners cheered. Blandoch stared delightedly at the frozen bird, while the non-frozen copies, tweets, and chirps rose from the floor. Blandoch turned to Gwen and the others and said,
"You've lived up to your part of the bargain. You've returned our beloved friend Oban to his rightful home."
Blandoch faced his fellow miners, spreading his arms wide and raising his voice.
"And now that he is back, we miners can mine again!"
The miners cheered. Blandoch turned back and in a quieter voice said,
"Now it is time for us to fulfill our half of the bargain. You came looking for Dialowine, did you not?"
Martin said, "Yeah, I guess."
"And you will have it," Blandoch said.
He leaned down and picked up his golden pickaxe, which was partially covered by Oban's cage. Lifting the axe sent the cage and its twittering occupant rolling across the floor. He grabbed a lantern that was hanging from a spike on the wall.
"Now that Oban is back," he said, "I can go mine it for you."
Blandoch walked toward the mine entrance at the rear of the chamber. Roy said,
"You forgot your bird."
Blandoch did not seem to hear him. Roy continued,
"Miners need canaries to tell them when there's too much CO2.
"Yeah,"
Britt agreed.
"Then why isn't he taking the bird with him?"
Britt said,
"Maybe because it's not a real bird." "Or a real mine,"
Gwen added.
"Or a real miner,"
Martin said. Blandoch got to the mine entrance, paused, then took a single step into the shaft. He looked at the ceiling and walls of the mine, then focused on a seemingly empty patch of ground. Blandoch put down the lantern and swung the pickaxe downward. It stopped abruptly and rung as if it had struck something solid, although it had stopped in midair. He put down the pick, then mimed as if he were lifting something heavy and round with both hands. He carried the invisible sphere back and presented it to Gwen, saying,
"Gentlemen, You have done us a great service this day, and it is our honor to present you with this Dylawine.
Gwen looked at the empty space between Blandoch's hands, then looked to her compatriots and shrugged. The three of them shrugged back, so she turned and put her hands out, accepting whatever it was that Blandoch was offering. Blandoch carefully placed the nothing in Gwen's arms, and she